Fred, what have you done now?
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the Brad Gilmore Show on demand. Welcome to episode 133. We got a special guest today. Spike Ferriston joins me. Spike Ferriston is well known in the comedy world. He has a new show on Podcast One called Spike's Car Radio. You might know Spike. He was a writer for David Letterman. He was a writer for Seinfeld, wrote the Soup Nazi episode. He also was an intern at Saturday Night Live. He had his own late-night television show, talk show with Spike Ferriston on Fox, the longest-running late-night show on Fox, and a myriad of other things. He is also the host of Spike's Car Matchmaker. So a lot of things Spike Ferriston is known for. We're excited to have him on the Brad Gilmore Show today. A very interesting guy to talk to. Another Seinfeld writer. We had Peter Melman on the show recently. This guy wrote for David Letterman as well. And in a couple weeks, we have Joe Toplin going to join us. Joe Toplin, of course, the author of Comedy Writing for Late Night Television, wrote for Jay Leno and David Letterman. So a myriad of awesome guests here on the Brad Gilmore Show on Demand. I hope you enjoyed our Rotten Tomatoes game last Friday with Matt Topolsky. We're going to be doing that more often here on the show. So I'm not going to keep this intro too long. I'm going to go ahead. We're going to transition right over right now, this very second. We're going to listen to my man, Spike Ferriston. We're going to talk cars. We're going to talk late night television. We're going to talk Seinfeld and his new podcast. Once again, that's Spike's Car Radio. New episodes drop every Wednesday on Podcast One. That's podcastone.com. Spike has, oh man, you know who Spike has on the show this week? He has Jeremy Piven. Yes, Ari Gold from Entourage. He's going to talk about cars and a lot of stuff he has going on. So real cool stuff. He's had Jerry Seinfeld on. He had Chris Hardwick on from The Nerdist. Really cool podcast if you're a fan of podcasts and you're listening to one, so of course you are. So let's go to my conversation right now with the one and only Spike Ferriston. Spike, how you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I am fantastic. Well, you know, actually, I kind of wish I was where you are right now because we're about to have a tropical storm here in Houston, Texas, and I'm sure it's bright and sunny in L.A.
It's very nice. It's a little sunny. It's a little muggy, but that's okay.
Well, I guess the question that would be on my mind first is, what car are you taking out today?
I'm going to be in the Range Rover Sport today.
Oh, okay. I like
that's
it.
That's the one I use when I know it's going to be hot. It's probably going to be 95 degrees out here. I'm going to be caught in a lot of traffic. So that's the one and I'm driving from end to end here in California, from the west side to the east side.
So that's going to be the car for you today is
yes,
the
sir.
Range Rover. Okay. Well, you mm-hmm. know what? You have a brand new show available on Podcast One and Apple Podcasts called Spike's Car Radio.
Right.
How did the podcast come about and why do it now?
This is something I've been doing with my friends. I've been taking a drive out in Malibu on the weekends and carving canyons in a variety of automobiles and then stopping for breakfast. And you know, I thought, I'd like to share the conversation because, as you know, a car guy, there aren't many other people to talk to when you're obsessed with cars. When you find other people who are, you really just want to sit and talk to them. So this is really an outreach program for those who are isolated and don't have a place to listen to car talk.
Well, you know, like the thing about it, though, is I heard you say this in an interview before. You're not a car guy in the sense of, I want to put a Hemi in this, and I, you know, this is how a carburetor works. You're a car guy, you know, based on the brand and style, right?
Well, I think of it this way. I'm first and foremost, I work in entertainment, and that's my primary job. The car thing is this hobby that when I'm not doing that, when I'm not with my family, this car thing is my golf. And what that really means is driving. I'm a driver more than anything else. I love to get in a variety of different automobiles or trucks and just take drives. And I find that to be relaxing. And then, you know, I do work here and there on things. And, you know, would I have a garage with a lift someday? But yeah, totally. That would be really fun. But I just don't have the time right now.
Yeah, but it's more about you just have the appreciation for automobiles. Now, here in Texas, especially in Houston, you can't get anywhere without having a vehicle. And the same in L.A., same in California. Different in, you know, the Northeast, but you have to have a vehicle. Right. But down here, you know, it's mainly a lot of trucks. You know, it's a lot of, you know, pickup trucks and not everything. But in Houston, there's a part outside of Houston, like in greater Houston area, called Humble. And out in Humble, they have a place that I'm sure you would appreciate. It's the headquarters for the DeLorean Motor Company. And I actually got to go out there and tour the DeLorean Motor Company. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they have boxes there with parts in them from West Germany. And, you know, West Germany is not even a country anymore. So it was a really cool experience for me. What do you think of the DeLorean? It's my favorite movie car of all time. That's why I was hyped to go there. But what do you think of the DeLorean?
I really like looking at it in a movie or on TV, but I don't want one.
Well, that's what everyone says. Everyone says they're like an awful car to drive.
But I don't know. I heard these guys, I think they have an outpost here in L.A. too somewhere. And I will reserve judgment. I don't know what they're up to as far as restoring these cars and making them drivable. But I've always heard they are absolutely awful to drive. But again, you know, I'm just taking the word of guys like Matt Farah.
well, to me, though, it's like the coolest.
And I know,
it's like the
you know, I happen
car.
To know here.
Yeah.
Here's some anecdotal information for you. Seth MacFarlane from Family Guy. You know who Seth MacFarlane is, right? He bought a DeLorean. He thought it would be cool to have the Back to the Future car. And it very much is cool when you read it in an interview that he bought a DeLorean. I really like that. I ran into him recently. I said, hey, what's up with the DeLorean? What are you doing with that thing? And he said, I'll be honest with you, Spike. I bought it. I put it in the garage and it hasn't come out once. It's a mess. It's an absolute mess.
You know,
I'm stuck in my own joke.
I think if you buy a DeLorean, it's only, I think you have to have all the Back to the Future parts on it. Like, or it's like really just like, why even have it?
Yeah. Or don't buy it.
Don't buy it. I think that's a good rule to go by.
I see. Again, this gets back to the driver thing for me. On a Saturday morning after I've dropped kids off at baseball and whatever I'm doing, I get like an hour or two to myself. I want to get in the car. I turn the key. It starts up. I roll the windows down. I put on some music. And then I'm just flowing down the road with the ocean on my left. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That is really enjoyable. And by the way, that can happen in a truck. You know, I've got an old Series 2A Land Rover from 1971 that goes about 48 miles an hour, top speed. It still engages me. You know, and I still get the same amount of satisfaction out of it. So that's what I'm looking for. If I were to get into a DeLorean, that feels like now I'm in a novelty car where I'm looking for tension or bringing it to car shows, but I'm probably not going to enjoy the engineering and the way the car drives, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on those old pickup trucks. I had a pickup truck that went 0 to 60 in like 4 days. It was my favorite car. Is the car radio though kind of an offshoot of the show on Esquire, the car matchmaker? Is it kind of go hand in hand?
It really doesn't. I mean, it's really born out of me and my friend Jerry Seinfeld and my friend Paul Zuckerman and us, you know, just hanging out and talking cars, talking comedy on the weekends. And, you know, we always thought we've been doing it for maybe 15 years. And Jerry and I have always thought this is a great podcast. But, you know, I wasn't really motivated to pursue it until Car Matchmaker came along. And Jerry and I were chatting about it soon after. He said, you know, it's really not a podcast. It's really a porch cast because we're on the porch of this Malibu kitchen. And I went, yeah, that would be if we could find a way to monetize breakfast. That's a pretty neat little trick.
Well, you know, I like your philosophy on life. Your philosophy is, how can I make money on the things that I do every day?
Right. but it's, you know, it's turned out to be pretty fun. You know, Jerry did the first one, and he's going to stop by as much as he's out in L.A. And this week we have Chris Hardwick on. And, you know, because I'm hosting Car Matchmaker, I meet a lot of people in the world of in Hollywood that you wouldn't know are car people. Michael Strahan's one of them. You know, I had no idea he collected cars. Joel McHale, you know, guys like that. So at least at the beginning of this podcast, we're going to pull a lot of them in, and I'm going to introduce you to them. We're going to hear what they're up to and what they collect. And not all of them are total gearheads, but they all seem to share this love of four-wheeled vehicles.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I listened to the debut episode with Jerry Seinfeld. I actually, though, this is what's cool about the show, is I wouldn't call myself a car guy. I have an appreciation for cars. But I actually found myself really entertained by the show, and I really didn't know what y'all were talking about half the time. Like, I had no idea right. the cars or anything, but it was actually still an enjoyable listen. Like, I love, it's like, you know, you're hanging out with your friends, and it's in a scene that you've never been in before, and you're listening to them talk, and for some reason, it's right. you think that you know what they're talking about, even though you don't, you pretend like you do, and you enjoy the conversation.
That's right. That's the idea. Well, car matchmakers, the same thing. We try to speak cars to people who don't understand cars. We don't drill down too deep on or get too granular.
Yeah. But Car Matchmaker is a great show on Esquire, but you had a show and you have an appreciation for late night television like I do. I love late night TV. I think it's awesome. Mm-hmm. And you started with Saturday Night Live and then worked with David Letterman, right?
Yes.
You work with Dave, I think, from 1990 to 95, and during the transition from NBC to CBS. And I always have to know, I talked to somebody who was a writer on Letterman a couple weeks ago, Joe Toplin, who wrote a book about it.
Oh, yeah.
And a very, very smart guy, insightful guy. But he wasn't there when Letterman went from NBC to CBS. I've always wanted to know, what was that transition like? And, I mean, were y'all all thinking, or being on the staff, that you were going to be writing for The Tonight Show?
No, we didn't want to. We loved working at NBC, and frankly, I mean, I'm just speaking for myself. I was completely confused why Dave would want 11:30. It made no sense to me. He had this hip late night show that started at 12:30 that was doing just fine. Why 11:30? That seemed more mainstream and safer. The biggest change I remember about the whole thing, aside from that confusion, and then the confusion of why NBC wouldn't put him at 11:30, was, you know, when we went to CBS, Dave, he really owned everything at that point. You know, before we kind of had NBC and GE to kind of brush up against, you know, the offices, the building, the whole dynamic there. And then we went to this friendlier CBS where Dave owned the whole Ed Sullivan Theater and, you know, the whole show. And, you know, we didn't quite have that that place to kind of rebel against this corporatized TV network, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it was fun and wonderful in a different way. We had a lot more room. We had a lot more autonomy. And, you know, you got used to it. But it was never quite the same as that 12:30 show at NBC. That was the show that I used to watch in college and that I wanted to work for. And, you know, like all things, they come to an end.
But, you know, I think that, you know, Dave eventually going to 11:30 anyway, it was weird for me. Like, I kind of grew up watching Tonight's Show, tail end of Carson, right, and then into Leno. And it wasn't until I got older that I thought David Letterman was just such a genius. I mean, he was so much funnier than everybody else on television.
Right.
I mean, it's mm-hmm. it's weird. It's almost like it hits you like puberty. All of a sudden you realize this guy is the most incredible thing on TV.
Yes. No. When I was a young idiot writer starting out, I hated Johnny Carson. And then as I grew older, I totally understood why he was, you know, a groundbreaking late night host. And after I did the job myself, I was stunned by it. You know, these guys are incredible.
Yeah, your show, talk show with Spike. I mean, it was a fun show. I watched a few clips today, in preparation for this, and it had
you know what?
And I'm not just saying this. It had a 12:35, you know, old Letterman kind of vibe to it. More focused on the writing than the guests, you know, and mm-hmm. just kind of it was in your own world. So that was your goal.
Yeah, we wanted to deconstruct the late night show and make it small again. And, you know, in some ways, that show was a little bit of a reaction to the 12:30 NBC show moving to CBS, where it got very, very big in this giant theater. And I remember thinking when I was talking to Fox about kind of having another look at a late night show, it was the idea that, you know, I always felt as an audience member when I was watching Dave at the Ed Sullivan Theater that the home audience was kind of outside of the show, that the audience in the theater was having the best time and the viewers at home were a little isolated because they were so engaged. What I loved about the 12:30 show at NBC was frequently the audience in the studio didn't get what Dave was doing. Half the time they were scratching their heads. And that's what I really like watching. I love that. So when it came time to kind of plan the Fox show, that's the dynamic we were going for. We were like, let's make this really small, really, really small, and kind of build out from there and have fun with the skyline and have a fake announcer. And just, you know, if the audience doesn't get it, that's just fine.
Yeah, it's almost better that way. It's almost better if they don't get it. You know, but you hit on something about, you know, deconstructing late night and making it small again. When you watch the shows, you know, The Tonight Show or Stephen Colbert now, they seem so grand. It's such a massive show now. It doesn't feel, even Carson, you know, even Carson, it felt like a smaller show. It didn't feel like this grand thing. And now it seems like it's a super produced thing. Do you think late night's suffering because of that?
No, it seems to be thriving because of the internet. I mean, when we were at Fox, the one thing that we started to notice was if we could get content onto the internet the next day, it was promoting the show. Like suddenly we had these viral videos flying around and, you know, you'd see your stuff on The View and you're like, well, this is the game to be in. You know, forget about the time slot. You know, the executives at Fox are noticing that we're all over the place on the internet the next day. And it's the same with these late night shows. I mean, Colbert is thriving right now on politics and the environment that's in the United States right now. Fallon seems to be waning a little bit because everything's so political. But, you know, I've seen these patterns over and over and over again. It ebbs and flows depending on where the country's head is at. And that's kind of the fun of late night. It adapts to that, or it doesn't, and it thrives, or it starts to dip a little bit. But you know, part of the fun of that late night show for all of these guys is connecting to that, you know, the zeitgeist of what we're all thinking about collectively at any given moment, and trying to hit those notes.
Do you think though? You think that Colbert's strategy as you know, he's so politically charged right now and he's thriving because of it. He's number one. And Jimmy Fallon, since that, you know, they call it now the Trump incident where he rubbed his head, has suffered in the ratings. Do you think, though, my first question is, do you think it's a smart strategy by Colbert for the long term to continue to beat down Trump? And then my follow-up would be, do you think Jimmy Fallon got too much flack for that interview?
Well, you know, Colbert will work as long as, you know, he'll only be doing Trump stuff as long as there is a Trump.
Yeah.
If you look at any late night monologue for you know, as long as there have been, they're always kind of reflective of pop culture. You know, when things, you know, right now the news cycle is just dominated by politics. It's just dominated. There's nothing else in it. And that's not the way things usually are. Usually it's a little bit of politics. I mean, I remember when I was writing Dave monologue jokes for Letterman, you're in there every morning reading the newspaper and then writing jokes, right? And I remember many, many months going by without any political stories of note going on where you're like, what are we going to write about today? There's nothing happening. Oh, here's a weird candy bar they invented with this weird name, or, you know, here's somebody on TMZ. Let's do that. Right now, it's just politics dominates the news cycle. So that means the guys who are pretty much doing it on whatever side they're taking, that is what people are going to watch. It's just because that's dominating the news cycle, and Fallon is going to win. I know he caught a lot of flack for that hair thing, but I don't know that that's the moment it turns, but it is an indication of you're not addressing a story that's sitting in your guest chair properly. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's what that moment shows more than anything else, which is the audience right now is looking for something a little more substantial. And you're not giving it to them in that moment, because in that moment, there's things going on with this person in your guest chair that beg you to acknowledge them. You know, that's the one thing I know for sure is your audience wants you to be their voice. And if you've got a guy in that guest chair and you're not asking questions kind of in the neighborhood of what's going on in the world, everything kind of feels off, right? And I think that is maybe what Jimmy would learn from that moment. But, you know, I think he's a, you know, an incredible performer and a fantastic host. And once the political cycle dies down, he'll be back to number one.
But you know what? Hearing you say that now kind of makes me think of that whole situation differently. It's almost the Jay Leno, Hugh Grant moment, right, where he asked him, you know, what the hell were you thinking? If had he not right. talked about the issue at all, you know, who knows what would have happened to Jay Leno. And
right.
So, yeah, I understand that.
Well, they begged him to come on for that moment, I heard. They begged him to come on. Come on, answer the question once, and you'll never have to answer it again. So that was pretty choreographed, that little moment. And it worked. And that's, you know, that's a great guest booking.
Yeah, no, it definitely. So the late night landscape is always fascinating me. But you went so from Letterman, and then from there you went back to NBC and started writing for Seinfeld. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And how did you kind of cross paths with Jerry Seinfeld or Larry David? How'd you even get the gig?
It was through two writers who I knew who helped me get the Letterman gig, Tom Gamble and Max Prost, and maybe George Meyer too. I'm not sure. You know, guys I knew from SNL and Letterman. Gamble and Prost had moved to Seinfeld, and there was a position open, and they asked me to do a submission.
And what do you remember? What you submitted?
No. No idea. I did two. The first year I submitted, they only had one spot open and I didn't get hired. So I think that must have been 94. And then I ran into Seinfeld in the elevator at Letterman. I had never met him before, but we were, you know, standing there. It was the end of a really bad week. And suddenly I'm in the elevator with a guy who didn't hire me a few months back. And I was introduced to him by the segment producer, and he went, "Oh, Spike Ferriston, didn't you do a submission for us?" And I go, "Yeah, yeah, same Spike Ferriston." He goes, "Well, whatever happened to that?" And I said, "Shouldn't you know that?" And then the elevator door opened, and I walked out. And then I walked home when I beat myself up for back-talking Jerry Seinfeld and going, "Well, I'm never getting hired on that show." But shortly after, they asked me to do a another submission, and I did. And I went to Larry David's house and got hired.
So when I talked to Peter Melman on this show as well, and Peter said to me, who was a writer on Seinfeld, and he said to me that he didn't realize until, you know, a few episodes in, the impact the show had on, you know, the pop culture, the zeitgeist of the nation. Were you aware walking in, because you walked in toward the later seasons, were you aware that everything you'd write on this show could blow up to, like, this major phenomenon?
To a certain extent, yes. But only because I had been working on this daily late night show and seen things pop left and right, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you put something up and suddenly it would be everywhere. I understood that could happen. I also understood that you never knew which thing would actually pop and what would happen. But the moment it really hit was the day after the Soup Nazi aired, where I came in, I was convinced I was going to be fired. I had written the worst episode in television. It was just bad. You know, and I remember sitting at breakfast and Jerry's assistant coming in going, "We're all over New York media right now." She goes, "Come in, look at this." And we all went into Jerry's office or her office, I don't recall. And there were stories about the Soup Nazi everywhere. We're like, "What the hell? What is this?" In fact, Jerry wasn't there yet because he came in shortly after that. And he went, "Boy, did I get a lot of phone calls about that show last night. That was a good one." You know, just the impact of that episode and where I thought I was, two completely different places.
So
and that was very surprising to me that episode popped and then continued to rate as good on the repeats as it did when it originally aired, and still people talk about it today. Still,
yeah, you know, I mean, when I was, you know, growing up, I mean, that was just in. You know how some things you don't know where you first saw it or where you first heard it? They just exist in your world. Like, the Soup Nazi just existed. I always remember it around. So where did – I know you've probably been asked this 1,000 times, but I have to ask, where did the inspiration for that show come from?
It was no inspiration. It really happened. It was a real guy in 55th and 8th in New York, and we used to get lunch there when I was a writer at Letterman, we being the Letterman writers.
And he would, and he had, did he have like the actual, like, you have to follow these steps in order to order my soup?
Exactly like it is in the episode.
That's wild.
Except there's one difference. The cashier girl, there was no cashier girl. It was all Al Yagana, the soup guy. He would take your order. He would then take your money. and then pull back your soup if he didn't want you to sell it to you.
Did you ever have your soup revoked from him? Did he
the
ever take it back from
time,
you?
Yes. Dave Hansen, one of the Letterman writers, took me there and said I had to order my soup a certain way. And I was just laughing at him, going, what the hell is wrong with you? Sorry.
No, you're fine.
And he said, and I said, he goes, you got to do it or you're not going to get soup. And I go, yeah, I'm pretty confident I know how to order soup at this point in my life. Yeah, and he took me, I gave him the money. I started talking to him and I was laughing and being casual. And he didn't let me order soup. Get out. Get away. No soup for you. And I went, wow, what's happening here?
And did it dawn on you? Oh, I guess you weren't at Seinfeld at that time. So I guess it just came to you later on when you were writing. You're like, hey, I remember ordering soup that one time. This might
no,
be an episode.
No, I was in my very first pitch session to Larry and Jerry when I first got hired. I was doing okay. I wasn't batting very well in the stories I pitched. And after the pitch was over, they were like, yeah, there's some good stuff here, some not. And nothing else happened in New York. And I told that story. And Larry started laughing hysterically. He goes, the soup Nazi? Well, there's your first episode. And then they kicked me out of their office, and I couldn't have been more confused. I didn't really understand how that was an episode, but there you go.
Yeah, there it is. I have to ask, so Larry and Jerry, as a team, I mean, could there have really been the Seinfeld as we know it without both of them? Were they just like the perfect answer to each other?
Yeah, absolutely. When they wrote together, it was Jerry and George, and they balanced them each other out just wonderfully. And you can see it now with the stuff they do, excuse me, after the fact. You know, when you see Larry do Curb, you see Larry David without the buffer of Jerry Seinfeld, or without that governor, maybe. You see very pure Larry David and George. And then you see the opposite when you see Jerry do stand-up these days. That's very pure Jerry. But when they're together, they balance each other out in a way that became that show.
It's just incredible. Now, to go back to car talk here for a second, I said my favorite movie car of all time is the DeLorean. What is your favorite movie car of all time?
excuse me. We've got a lot of pollen in the air today.
I was about to say, man, it's early in the morning over there.
Yeah, I'm ripping bong hits here. A favorite movie car... I guess the Magnum PI Ferrari 308. I've always loved that. I think out of just any crazy movie car. But you know, as far as movies and cars, American Graffiti is the movie that comes to mind. I really love that movie, and I really love what it captures with cars, and you know, in a time in America that was just driving and having fun. You know what I mean?
No, I got you. So a couple more things before I let you go. So you talk about your relationship with Jerry Seinfeld. Y'all are always talking about cars. He was on the first episode of your show on Podcast mm-hmm. One, Spike's Car Talk, Spike's Car Radio, excuse me. And what do you think? He's obviously known. He and Leno are known for having the vast collection of cars. Jerry likes a lot of Porsches. That's what everyone knows. What is your favorite car of Jerry's? Because you helped him buy some cars, right?
My favorite car of Jerry's?
Yeah.
That would be boy. There's so many of them. It's tough. But I would have to say the Porsche 917, the race car that used to belong to Steve McQueen that was used as a camera car in the movie Le Mans. That's probably it. That thing is just that's just hot car sex. Look at it and you lose your mind. And then when you're sitting in it and knowing the King of Cool McQueen was in it, that's a pretty big deal.
Can you though? So you play the car. You're on Car Matchmaker. That's your show. Do you just have the ability to like within a few minutes of talking to somebody realize what their perfect car would be?
No, we take that pretty seriously on the show. We do a lot of research. We have men and women on the production staff, and we really dig deep into it. I can tell right away, like most of us can, just what I'm dealing with. You know, usually if you know anything about cars, and if your listeners do, they know that your friends and your family come to you and they ask you questions, and you can tell right away if someone doesn't want to listen to you and doesn't want help and just wants you to validate their choice, or if they really want, you know, some help. Most of the time, all of them don't listen to what you have to say. And the only advantage I have is I can not just give them advice with my mouth. I can kind of put them in the car and they can drive my advice, and that usually changes minds.
No, I can understand that. See, that was my thing. I recently, you know, like I said, we're here in Texas, so I have a truck like everybody else has a truck. But, you know, you are right. I had like this thing of what I wanted in my mind and what I'd show to people. And I just want them to say, yes, that's the right car for you.
Right.
Exactly. It is hard to actually, you know, I guess it's just like life. It's hard to listen to someone else's advice. You just really want, you know, you want your choice validated.
There are people out there who do want it, who don't get it. Like, my favorite is guys who've never driven a performance car, who like, I have Porsche, BMW, I don't like that stuff. But, you know, and I can get them behind the wheel of a car and they go, oh my God, now I get what you're talking about. I can never go back. It's like putting on Nikes for the first time when you've been running in old leather shoes of some kind, and you go, here, try this. Try jogging in this Nike sneaker. That moment, and even if it's not a Porsche, even if it's just someone who just didn't know a car existed, like a friend of my wife who cuts her hair, commutes 60 miles every day, and was losing a fortune just paying for gas in traffic. I said, do you know what a Chevy Volt is? She goes, what is that? He goes, plug-in hybrid electric thing. You're going to love it. She goes, what? I didn't know what that means. I go, you plug it in when you get it home at night. You plug it in when you get it to work, and you're going to save so much money. And it's about the size of a Prius, but looks a little better than that.
A little bit more aesthetically,
and,
please.
And she is so – she had no idea. She's so happy with this car. She's saving so much money with it. That's the person I like to help. The person who really doesn't know anything, has been afraid to ask, and I can give them three choices that will work perfectly in their life.
You know, a friend of mine just got about 6 months ago a I think it's an 09 Bentley Brooklyn. And I mean, I didn't even want to drive it because, you know, like I said, I'm a truck guy. I don't even know what to do behind a foreign vehicle at all. And I got behind it, and I kind of had that realization you did of like, wow, this is real smooth. This turns easy. This is easy to drive. You know, I didn't even know these kind of cars existed. So it is always fun to get behind a wheel of something you have. You know, I mean, a truck, it's just rough and rugged. You know, I always.
What does your friend do that he's driving that thing around?
He's a lawyer. and here in Houston,
what kind of lawyer? Personal injury?
Yes, personal injury.
Personal injury. That car helps. That's why I said that. I know personal injury lawyers, and that's part of the sell.
You're the guy who's on your show with you is a personal injury lawyer,
at
right?
The Real Zuckerman.
Yes.
At The Real Zuckerman told me that he wants his parking lot filled with nice cars, so when the client comes in, they know this guy is going to get me the money. And that's what your friend with the Brooklyns is doing.
Yes, that's exactly. That's his strategy. So, well, Spike, I appreciate you coming on. I love the podcast. Love the show. I'm going to be tuning in every single week. You have Hardwick this week. Do you know who you have next week?
Jeremy Piven.
Oh, wow. There's a good kid.
Jeremy Piven.
Yeah.
I've been trying to get him an early 9/11 for about a year. I didn't complain to him as much as I wanted to about his indecision, but he was a fantastic guest, and we, you know, not just go through cars, we talk about his new CBS show and his history. It's kind of just history growing up without money and living in an old age home with his parents, which is something I never knew about him, but cool guy. Well, and then we're going to have Russell Peters on after that, the comedian, lots of really cool guests. So you check it out on Podcast One app. And Apple Podcasts and podcast1.com.
And Spike,
follow me on Instagram.
There you go.
That's where I have the most fun.
Spike, I really appreciate your time.
All right, man.
Take care. Thank you so much.
All right. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Oh, Brian, what have you done now?